From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the day suddenly got busier in Washington. John Dowd, President Trump's lead lawyer in the Russia investigation, has resigned, telling NPR's Tamara Keith he loved the president and wishes him well. But sources tell the New York Times that he's leaving because he thinks President Trump is increasingly ignoring his advice. And in Congress, lawmakers are scrambling to pass a $1.3 trillion budget deal they only made public last night. It must pass by midnight tomorrow in order to avoid a government shutdown. Let's bring in NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, what do you make of Dowd leaving? He was out front just this past Sunday with tweets about the Mueller probe.
Well, it's been brewing for some time, and, you know, Dowd and other attorneys just haven't been able to really get a handle on President Trump. You know, it's very difficult if you're an attorney, and this is an important subject, obviously, and you're trying to limit your client's exposure. And if that client doesn't take your advice, there's not a whole lot that you can do. And you're constantly trying to put out fires, trying to constantly, try to change statements and work on the fly. And that doesn't really, that's not something that lawyers like to do. They like to have things planned out, plotted out, and have a strategy going forward. And that made it very difficult when you had President Trump doing what he does all the time. Not to mention the fact that if you're an attorney for President Trump or you're any contractor for President Trump, you can never be sure if you're going to get paid.
Well, there's that. And the president did bring in a new lawyer who's been sort of a pit bull on, you know, on TV criticizing the Justice Department. Do you think that, you know, that was part of the shakeup?
I think President Trump watches TV and he sees people go on TV. And if they do a good job, then he wonders if there is somebody who maybe could work with him and if it's somebody that he likes what they have to say. So he watches TV, he watches Fox News, and he sees people who he thinks are good communicators. He's had problems with the communications team in the White House, doesn't necessarily like how they present themselves. So for the moment, the flavor of President Trump's selection here is Joe DiGenova, and thinking that he could do a pretty good job. But you know, we've seen this time and time again where he feels like the people who are working with him and for him aren't doing the best job that they possibly can. They're not presenting themselves in the way that he would prefer them to. So he goes to someone else. They do the job for a little while, and then his focus winds up going to someone else, or he thinks that they're not doing as good a job. And it doesn't seem like the kind of lesson that a lot of people who go to work for Trump have learned in Washington.
Well, we also want to mention that the House Intelligence Committee voted on party lines to end its investigation of Russian interference in the U.S. election and possible Trump campaign collusion today. No surprise there. That was kind of expected. But I want to mention the budget, which was the lead story, you know, till just a bit ago. It gives a pay raise to troops. It increases not only military spending, but money for domestic programs, something conservatives don't like, Democrats don't like, that it leaves out an extension of the DACA program to protect some young immigrants. And President Trump didn't get all the money he wants for a border wall. Is everyone just holding their noses here?
Well, you know, that's part of what a negotiation is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not everybody gets everything they want. The Congress is clearly sharply divided. That's no news. And in order to get some kind of funding measure through, they're going to have to do things that are scaled back, measures that maybe not everybody likes. For example, President Trump wanted $25 billion for a wall. The Democrats in Congress were certainly not going to allow that. And Republicans couldn't pass this omnibus by themselves. So they got $1.6 billion, and it's going to go mostly toward technology for security on the border. That is not a wall, but President Trump, not happy with that, but will take it. And there's also this contentious issue of this tunnel in New York and New Jersey. That's a big infrastructure project. President Trump feels like if he's not going to get his wall, why should Chuck Schumer get his tunnel? And it's really kind of amazing given President Trump is a New Yorker, and he's not really in favor of the largest infrastructure project in the country. What's happening with that money is that it's actually not going directly to this project. President Trump said he would veto it if it did. Instead, it's going to Amtrak and earmarked for what they can use in the Northeast. And they are planning to use that money, multiple hundreds of millions of dollars, on trying to improve the infrastructure, which was badly damaged during Superstorm Sandy a few years ago.
I was going to say, I mean, when all of this falls apart, people may be in more favor of it. But Rand Paul, he's kind of reliable this way. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul tweeted, shame, shame, a pox on both houses and parties, $1.3 trillion. You know, bust the budget.
Well, look, Rand Paul was elected saying, I have a message from the Tea Party. And the Tea Party stood for taxed enough already. And their big thing that they cared about was the budget and the debt and the growing national debt. And this certainly will add to the national debt. And Rand Paul feels like, why was he elected and why was there this movement that swept Republicans back into Congress if now they're going to be the ones running up a national debt when they were criticizing President Obama, who ran up debts because he was trying to help fix the economy after the Great Recession.
It's so interesting. The Tea Party seems like so long ago. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And by the way, Rand Paul did vote for the $1.5 trillion tax cut. We should note that as
which
well, which added
to,
a lot to the debt as well. Well, Facebook stock dropped again this morning on Wall Street after some rare interviews given by CEO Mark Zuckerberg yesterday. He's been making the media rounds to address fallout over the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. Facebook is being criticized for not doing more to protect user data after it was revealed that Cambridge Analytica gathered data from millions of users without their consent, and that data was used by the Trump campaign. Here's Zuckerberg speaking yesterday on CNN.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data. And if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
Joining us now from San Francisco is Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios. Hi, Ina.
Hey, Jeremy.
And just the fact that Zuckerberg was out there doing interviews gives you a sense of how serious this has been for Facebook. A lot of people deleting or deactivating their accounts.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people talking about deactivating their accounts, we should say. Facebook has made the point that so far they're not seeing a meaningful number. Obviously, that's a huge concern if it happens, regulation being the other big thing that they want to get out in front.
Well, let's listen to what Zuckerberg said about regulation. He said he's open to Facebook being regulated.
I actually am not sure we shouldn't be regulated. I think in general, technology is an increasingly important trend in the world. And I actually think the question is more, what is the right regulation rather than yes or no, should it be regulated?
Ina, is that likely? And what do you think it would mean?
Yeah, I think we should be clear that I think Facebook is just recognizing reality here. I don't think they're in favor of giant regulation of themselves or any other tech companies. I think they recognize that some regulations are likely, and I think they'll focus their energy on trying to make sure it's regulations they can live with. I think the kinds of things you'll see them support are things like disclosure in political advertising, which doesn't really hurt their business to a large degree. I don't think you'll see them in favor of big data privacy legislation.
Zuckerberg also told CNN he would be happy to testify before Congress. Let's listen.
The question in a question of congressional testimony is, what is the goal, right? And that's not a media opportunity, right? Or at least it's not supposed to be. The goal there, I think, is to get Congress all the information that they need to do their extremely important job. And we just want to make sure that we send whoever is best informed at doing that.
Ina, how likely is it that Zuckerberg himself will testify before Congress? He sounds a little cagey there.
I think it's possible. I think in general, they would prefer to send somebody else for a variety of reasons. And I think, you know, the headlines we saw were Zuckerberg willing to testify and not enough attention paid to the asterisk or the but here, which is if he's the right person. So I think it's still possible. I think, you know, Facebook will weigh the optics of it, the importance of sending him versus the benefits of sending somebody else, in addition to the point he raised about who is technically best suited.
Zuckerberg also did an interview with Recode, and something he said there was he talked about his discomfort in being an arbiter of permissible and impermissible speech. Tell us more about what he said there.
Sure. So this relates to the broader issue that Facebook is facing of how do you decide what content should be allowed on the site? And, you know, on one hand, it's very understandable. You know, the idea of what speech is permissible shouldn't necessarily be left up to any one company. And I think that's part of the point that he's making. I think the complexity here is that Facebook did create its platform. So it's certainly responsible for policing it. That doesn't necessarily mean it alone should set the standards. I think there are ways where a variety of constituencies could help Facebook write the rules, but I think Facebook is ultimately responsible for policing it. And I think too often this gets cast as either companies are the arbiter of free speech or they do nothing. And I don't think it needs to be that black and white.
We've talked about Facebook users. What about the people who actually work at Facebook? I've seen reports that many people now want to work in the Instagram or WhatsApp divisions, both owned by Facebook, because they don't want to have anything to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, I think these things hit morale in a variety of ways. I think there's two issues. One, there have been a small number of people that have been dealing directly with this, including the head of security, who have been having internal debates about how open Facebook should have been. And so I think in that part of the company, it's really about the debate over how best to handle it. I think in a lot of the company, it's, you know, the kind of shell shock whenever your own company is the one in the news. I think a lot of people within Facebook, certainly the policy folks, feel like these are issues that Facebook actually did address a few years ago, and it's getting a bad rap and it's the victim here. But certainly these things take a toll over time.
It's Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Ina, thank you.
Thanks.
And every now and then, we like to turn the microphone over to someone with a great story. Today, 87-year-old Isaac Shapiro, whose memoir has just been reissued, and it's a doozy. It's titled Edoko, which means child of Edo, the former name of Tokyo, and that's what he was, growing up with his family, a stateless foreigner in wartime Japan. He was the son of Russian-Jewish musicians who fled persecution during the Bolshevik Revolution, then moved around the world as Hitler began his rise, from Germany to France, and in 1931 to Japan, where Isaac was born. His mom made a side trip to China, where she'd partly grown up. That's another story. But mostly, like many people without a country today, Isaac lived in Japan with a front seat on history. Wait till you hear, as Isaac Shapiro joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Start with being in Japan. Japan aligned with Nazi Germany. I can't imagine how your parents felt, having been chased by Hitler from other countries.
Well, my first memories were really not of Japan, because my mother actually was born in Russia, in Odessa, but she was brought to China after the anti-Jewish pogroms in Odessa. When I was 6 months old, my parents separated, and my mother took us four sons in 1931 and took us to China, where her father lived.
We weren't even going to go here, Isaac, because this is a whole story unto itself. Your parents, as you said, separated. Your mother takes four boys, couldn't have been easy, goes to China, where she's kidnapped for ransom along with a man that she'd met. He's later murdered. I mean, she escapes. This is before you get to World War II in Japan.
That's right. And books have been written about that kidnap story. It was a horrible event.
Yeah.
But anyway, in 1936, she reconciled with my father, and we went from Manchuria to Tokyo. But we were very much aware of what was going on in the late 30s, that the war was expanding into a world war.
1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. But then the firebombing, the carpet bombing of Tokyo by the U.S., you write about your mom on the roof with a broom trying to sweep sparks away. What was that like?
Well, it was pretty frightening. I was all of 13 when fire raids came to Tokyo in the fall of 44. And then we left Tokyo after the big attack of March 10th and took refuge in a village 100 miles north of Tokyo, Karaizawa. Mm.
Who are you identifying with at this point? The child of Russian musicians who lived in countries around the world. Now here in Tokyo, you're speaking fluent Japanese, but I also understand, you know, reading the Rover Boys and listening to classical Western music. Who were you identifying as?
That's a hard question to answer. I think I always fancied going to America eventually. English was our main language. I spoke to my brothers in English. The language we dreamed in, the language we talked to each other in. The Japanese did not treat us as their enemies, because we were stateless, and we felt reasonably comfortable, except for the food rationing and the bombing.
Well, hold on. Reasonably comfortable? You had malnutrition. You were getting sores on your hands and feet. You did not have food.
No, that's correct. But nevertheless, I can't really say that I was an unhappy boy. I wasn't. I had lots of good friends. Or when the war ended, I literally ran away from home. I was very eager to meet the American troops.
Describe this scene. Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been bombed. There's an announcement that comes across, you know, language.
It's the emperor speaking.
Yeah. Not saying surrender.
Not really, no. Just that the time had come to call an end to the war.
So this announcement comes, and it sounds as if, you know, young Isaac Shapiro feels liberated. Now, people have been told, stay inside your homes.
Yes. You know,
very, very tender time. Like, what's going to happen? The Japanese are surrendering. And everybody was told, nobody go on the streets. Stay inside your homes. You jump on your bike?
Yes. There was no one in the streets. And this military policeman chased me. But finally, I got away from him.
Where were you going?
Just riding around. I wasn't going anywhere at that point. Just excited, very excited. And it was fun to ride a bicycle. And all the excitement.
Right. Well, but then, 14 years old, you decide you're going to go to Tokyo against your parents' wishes. You write, scarcely 2 weeks later, you found yourself aboard the USS Iowa, anchored near its sister battleship, the USS Missouri, and 300 other American Allied vessels crammed into Tokyo Bay. You just decided to up and go to Tokyo.
Yes. And then to go down to Yokohama and sit on the boardwalk and watch the boats come in. It seems obvious to me now looking back that I was not risk averse. I didn't consider the risk.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it. I just did what I instinctively wanted to do. Very strong-willed, I guess. And then I started to meet the troops, and first the army hired me. Then as I was walking to the train station, this jeep with naval officers pulled up and took me down to their anchorage. They took me aboard and fed me. And I remember meeting Admiral Halsey and Admiral McCain, and then witnessing the surrender ceremony on September 2nd from the deck of the Iowa alongside of the USS Missouri, where MacArthur was officiating. And then I was introduced by a naval captain, Captain Duckworth, to Marine Colonel Munn, who was taking over the airbase. And Duckworth said to him, you get the airbase, but you also get this 14-year-old kid. And I had learned how to drive. Marines had taught me how to drive a jeep. So I became his interpreter and driver. And
you're 14.
I'm 14 years old. And he said to me, I'd like to bring you back to America. So he sat down with my parents, and they agreed. And in July of 1946, this Vice Admiral Strubel was sent to Japan, and he didn't know it, but he was sent there to pick me up and take me to Hawaii.
A vice admiral. Listen, yes. Before you went to the U.S., there was another moment, which, again, for a 14-year-old, we're just wondering what that was like, when you were asked to go be the interpreter accompanying some U.S. military people at Hiroshima.
We walked around these horrible, destroyed streets. I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
And it was just devastating. No one said a word on the way back. It was just a riveting experience to see Hiroshima in October of 1945.
Well, and also 14 years old.
Yes.
I mean, it seems as if some of this was adventure.
I welcomed adventure and enjoyed the life I was living as this mascot of the U.S. Marine Corps.
Well, I was thinking that it was adventure maybe till that moment.
No, it was quite different because of the devastation and the realization that one bomb had done, you know, thousands of times more damage. It didn't occur to me then, but later on I thought if Japan had not surrendered, eventually all of the cities in Japan would have been pulverized.
Where you were as well.
Yes. And then I started to hear these military songs about how we're going to make a graveyard of Japan. That's what the Americans were singing to each other, the military, that they were going to bomb the hell out of Japan and make a graveyard out of it. Well, then I did realize that had the war continued, it would have been, we would all have been wiped out.
Right. Well, so you make your way to the United States. I mean, years later, I loved seeing that you are the head of the
Japan Society
in New York. You meet the emperor.
Yes.
That you heard on the radio that night. What a life, Isaac Shapiro. Is there a part of you still that holds on to that early life?
Well, I have a link with my past because lots of Hawaiian songs just got to me. Mm-hmm. And I still sing them every day. It's now 60 years later or so.
Can you sing one for us?
Sure. Coconut Willie lives in a tree. Plenty pupuli, it's easy to see. All the malahinis think he's a king. They come to Waikiki to see his opu swing. Opu means stomach.
Okay.
So my past is embedded.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask you, the classical music was so much a part of Western.
Yes, it still is. Yeah. I listen to it every day. My musical experience was based on listening to my mother. And as a little boy, I would sit and listen to her. I still think of her as, do you know who Clara Schumann was?
Sure. Let's see. Rare female composer and pianist, Romantic era, wife of Robert Schumann.
Okay. I think of my mother as the Clara Schumann of the 20th century. Clara had, I think, 6 children. And my mother was a professional pianist who raised 5 sons eventually. Her favorite music was romantic music, Chopin, Schubert, Schumann.
Well, I see you at your mother's knee. I see you as the little boy bursting out of a house, pushing through a wooden gate, hopping on your bicycle, with a Japanese officer chasing you with a sword, by the way, as you go out in defiance of the emperor's orders. Or we see you, this kid, with these military leaders, or in Hiroshima. And we leave you with some of your favorite music. That's Isaac Shapiro. His book is Eidoko, Growing Up a Stateless Foreigner in Wartime Japan. It's quite a tale. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
And so far, March Madness is living up to its nickname. The tournament has featured something that's never happened before. A number 16 seed, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, beating a top seed, Virginia. There were other upsets, some blowouts, buzzer beaters, and of course, a 98-year-old nun. Let's check in on the tournament as it resumes tonight with Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Is your bracket ruined?
Wow, ruined. I mean, does Jackson Pollock ruin a canvas? It's abstract art at this point. It's a lot of arrows and X's.
Well, how would you characterize the tournament so far? The Florida State coach, Leonard Hamilton, says the upsets so far represent a revolution in college basketball.
Yeah, but the revolution was a long time coming. Hamilton's been coaching for almost 50 years. I defer to his knowledge. But if he's implying that this is sudden, it's not. For years, the best players in college basketball stay 1 year and leave. There's huge turnover. So teams that are good in the regular season sometimes get into the postseason and their inexperience is exposed. Sometimes a freshman can power a team to upsets. So yeah, it's a much less stable sport in general. And then add to the fact, in all the other major sports except football, there are series. And so one unusual game does not mean that the loser is out. But of course, in this sport, there is. Look, you only need to win 6 games. I mean, it's a monumental task. But you only need to win 6 games to be the national champion. You could win 6 games and not even get out of the second round of the NBA playoffs. So there's that, too.
What about that 98-year-old nun from Chicago, Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt? She prays with the Loyola Chicago team before every game. Here she is explaining her prayer on Good Morning America.
At the end of the game, we want to be sure that when the buzzer goes off, that the numbers indicate that we get the big W. I pray for the other team, perhaps not as hard.
She's been a star of this tournament.
Yeah, yeah. She takes a little off the gas when she prays for the other team. Right, I don't know what the Lord would think about that. But, you know, another star is the daughter of the Nevada coach, Eric Musselman, Mariah Musselman. She interviews her dad. So you have on the extreme ends of the spectrum, these two ladies who are captivating. And that's a great thing about March Madness. Even with a lot of the players, if you really follow college basketball, you might know them. But not a lot of people really follow college basketball. The ratings for the regular season are really, really low. So it's an odd tournament where people identify as fans of the sport, and yet they might only know four or five players. So a guy like Jordan Poole hits this game-winning shot for Michigan. Who is this guy? Turns out he's obsessed with cats, and people were mistaken him for Jordan Peele. And there are all these sort of stories and all these sort of personalities that just burst onto the scene suddenly. So it's one of the things that makes it a great experience.
So we're down to the Sweet 16 now. The Final Four will be on Sunday night. And on the women's side, there's more Sweet 16 action in the women's tournament starting tomorrow night. Top seed Connecticut won its first game over St. Francis, 140-52.
Yeah.
Can anyone beat the Huskies this year?
Well, you know, that's what we asked last year. Mississippi State didn't. So maybe we should pay attention to Mississippi State. They're a number one team. They still wear the crown. But I think the question is right, because Connecticut has shown through the course of its experience in the last decade, they are so good. And right now, 538, an excellent prognostication service, says they have an over 90% chance of making the Final Four. No one else is above 60.
That's Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, who has who winning in the men's tournament?
Loyola and Sister Loyola. Jean, of course.
All right, okay.
Why not?
Longtime Fox News analyst, retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, will not renew his contract with Fox News. And a note he wrote about that is reportedly sending shockwaves through Fox. The note was leaked to BuzzFeed. In it, Peters said that the news channel had become a propaganda machine for President Trump and that the company is assaulting our constitutional order and the rule of law. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. David, thoughts?
You know, retired Colonel Ralph Peters typed up a note that in some ways articulated the concerns that are creating a lot of fissures and in fact, canyons within Fox News. The question is, how much is news a part of the Fox identity? It has always been that the opinion tail wagged the news dog. It is what is most profitable. It is what binds the loyalty of its base viewership to the network, much as you know, what President Trump has to say binds his core voters. But there are a lot of people there, even conservatives within the network, who are deeply concerned about the fact that Fox is not representing a conservative points of view, but simply throwing in its lot with President Trump, binding itself to a person, even at a time at which his activities, his behavior, his conduct and his policies have come under attack, not simply from the left, but from the right as well. Fox has really, you know, in this incarnation, said it's not conservative, it's not just Republican, it is Trump TV. And that's, you know, a problematic thing for one of the nation's leading news outlets.
Yeah, well, Fox News anchor, Sunday anchor Chris Wallace, for example, has spoken out against the way Fox News personalities, opinion makers, have been attacking the media. So some have spoken out. We want to also say that Fox News responded to Peters' note in a statement by saying, Ralph Peters is entitled to his opinion despite the fact that he's choosing to use it as a weapon in order to gain attention. We're extremely proud of our top-rated primetime hosts and all our opinion programming. And while there are some, as you say, even on the right, Republicans, cheering him, the president of Media Matters, which monitors Fox Media, said that Peter deserves no accolades here. For more than a decade, he was reliable and unwavering in advancing the Fox News agenda. We just want to listen to a little bit of retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. Here he is speaking about President Obama.
This is a president who cares more about thugs in Guantanamo or thugs in Ferguson, Missouri, than he does about law-abiding American citizens and their right to live in safety and peace.
David, your thoughts about that, that he was a part of the problem he's now pointing out?
Well, and let's be very clear, Media Matters is quite a liberal organization that has had ties particularly to Hillary Clinton, and yet it does an extremely good job of monitoring what is said in some of the threads there in an impressive way. Ralph Peters, you can look at him one of two ways. He is part of, for years, Fox's in some ways distilled and increasingly partisan and often ignoring a countervailing fact approach to its opinions and sometimes its news coverage as well. And so Peters was used when it was useful as a battering ram against rhetorically against the Obama and the Obama administration. By the same token, I think it gives him more standing to make this argument that even within the ideological right, and Peters has written as well for the New York Post, which is in some ways a sibling outfit because both are ultimately controlled by Rupert Murdoch. It gives Peters standing to make this argument in a way that's tougher for Fox to dismiss. I think it's worth pointing out in that statement from Fox News, you know, even as they stand up for their opinion hosts, they do a classic Fox News things, which is to talk about how Peters is seeking merely to gain attention. The number of times Fox News goes after its former talent for being petty, for being gaining attention, for having failed in the ratings, for whatever excuse they hang on to in you know, making counter arguments, seems to suggest that there's something broken in the process by which Fox News hired people. If at every point somebody emerges with criticisms of the network, they find ways to assail their character.
David Folkenflik, before we let you go, we have to ask about Steve Bannon, another conservative in the media at Breitbart News and then in the headlines this week because he co-founded that data mining company, Cambridge Analytica. And to some people's surprise, he's going to be speaking in a Financial Times event today on the future of news. Some people think that he is the one who's warping news. Your thoughts on him being chosen to speak there?
Well, clearly the folks at the Financial Times who are hosting this conference feel that what he has to say is newsworthy. And it's hard to argue that point given what we're seeing in the headlines right now. It is certainly the case that I think Steve Bannon is hostile to what the rest of the more conventional media is up to in terms of its reporting, in terms of the kinds of accountability it attempts to provide on people in power. Currently, those in power in Washington are Republicans and conservatives. He would argue insufficiently conservative. But I think a lot of people are going to want to hear what he has to say about this scandal enveloping both Cambridge Analytica and Facebook itself and about the state of politics. It's certainly controversial. You have Steve Bannon, who just recently told French members of the National Front Party that they should embrace the mantle of being called racists, that it is something to wear with pride. So I think anybody who embraces that mantle is justifiably worthy of intense scrutiny, even if it's uncomfortable to see him at a media conference, being the platform on which he does that.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, we've noted that this week is the six-month anniversary of Hurricane Maria devastating Puerto Rico, forcing many residents to evacuate to communities on the mainland. Many of them, including 450 school-age children, relocated to Hartford, Connecticut. A quarter of those new arrivals are in Hartford public high schools, a system already dealing with budget cuts and a lot of unmet needs. Connecticut Public Radio's Vanessa De La Torre reports.
Bridget Allison is a teacher at Hartford Public High School. After the hurricane, Puerto Rican evacuees ended up in her fourth period class.
You see where it says related articles? Yes. Click on it.
Allison says she's happy to have them, but is also a bit stressed out.
We already don't have what we need to help these students. We do not have enough ESL teachers.
Hartford is a city on the verge of bankruptcy. It's also a place with rich cultural ties to the Caribbean. So when school leaders heard how badly Puerto Rico was hit, they started to game plan, figuring that the storm would have a ripple effect on this district in Connecticut. Superintendent Leslie Torres Rodriguez is originally from Puerto Rico. She understands the journey of arriving in Hartford as a child, not knowing English. But now that the evacuees are here, it's been tricky.
Back in September, I was not anticipating having 448 students, which is what we have today.
At first, Hartford steered the evacuees to schools with plenty of Spanish-speaking staff. They called them hub schools. That's Justin Quiñones, an 18-year-old evacuee. He says he wanted to go to the Buckley Hub School, but it already had more than 70 evacuees, so he was turned away. Quiñones is now at Hartford High with about 30 other evacuees, including 17-year-old Alonda Medina. She says it's different because they went from all Spanish to taking classes in English. But both Quiñones and Medina say they're happy with their education here, even if they sometimes have to rely on the internet for translation.
We use the Google Translate.
Teacher Bridget Allison thinks they deserve more. She says she can spend only a few minutes during class to check in and see if they understood her English.
When I look at Justin and I look at Alondra and I look at the help that I'm able to give them, it's good, but it could be so much better. And that is one of the things that I find very heartbreaking, because I would not ever tolerate that for my own child.
The superintendent says the cash-strapped district will spend well over $1 million this year to educate the new arrivals. Torres Rodriguez thought the federal government would help offset the cost, but that hasn't happened yet.
I'm expecting the money. I'm expecting the money so that I can provide the resources that our students deserve.
Thomas Baldino is English as a second language coach at Hartford High. He's been working with the students from Puerto Rico.
They're sad because they miss their country. They're in shock. And I tell every single student that comes here, I just said, have patience with yourself, have patience with the process of learning, and have patience with the teachers. Because if you're frustrated, sometimes the teachers get frustrated too, because they want to be able to reach you, and sometimes it's hard.
6 months after the hurricane, Baldino says the Puerto Rican students are still coping with the devastation.
Their island is in deep trouble, and I feel for them.
Meanwhile, the high school days are rushing by. Medina just took the SATs, and Quiñones is thinking of going back to Puerto Rico for college. They say the different pace in Hartford has been hard to get used to, although they do expect to graduate this year. But there's one thing they're not so sure about.
Are you guys going to prom?
I don't know. Because I don't know.
For Here and Now, I'm Vanessa De La Torre in Hartford.
There's some new research out today that shows the aging process can be reversed, at least in mice. The research is being published today in the journal Cell, and joining us now is David Sinclair, who is the senior investigator of the study. He's a professor and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biology of Aging at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sinclair, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here, and this research specifically looks at blood vessels in mice. What did you find about what happens to blood vessels as they age?
Well, as I'm sure many listeners know, as we get older, we lose our vitality, we become weaker, we're less able to exercise. We just don't feel young anymore. And one of the main reasons for that is that we don't have the blood vessels flowing through our bodies as we used to. And as a result, what happens is that our tissues, our organs, they don't get enough blood supply and they become deficient in oxygen. But also what happens is that they can't clear out the toxins. And this combination ends up leaving our tissues and organs susceptible to diseases from liver failure, kidney failure, and even dementia. And what we are showing in this new study is that's actually quite reversible, at least in mice so far.
How did you manage to do that? How do you reverse that aging process in the blood vessels?
Well, we've been over at Harvard working on this for a number of years, 20 years. We first worked on the red wine molecule, resveratrol. Now we have new molecules that we think are even better. And it turns out it's pretty simple how it works. We've figured out that there are genes in our bodies that respond to exercise and dieting, and we can turn those on with just some small molecules that seem to be safe so far in mice and even so far safe in humans.
And so then what happens?
Well, when you give the molecule to the mice, what happens is their bodies, at least the blood vessels, they rejuvenate. They actually become no longer deaf to the signals from muscle. So they behave as though the mice have been exercising. And we have mice that in the lab are 2 years old, which is like a 75, 80-year-old human. And within a few weeks, they become as fit and as vital as a young mouse again.
And you found that those animals showed between 56 and 80% greater exercise capacity compared with the untreated mice in the study.
Yeah, that's right. We've even done better than that since we put together this study. We now have old mice out racing, outdoing the young mice in the study. We've got mice now that can run three times as long as their control mice in the study. In fact, these mice ran so far that the little treadmill in the lab stopped because the software had never expected to see a mouse that could run 3 kilometers.
Hmm. Now, not many studies that show results in mice translate to humans, but do you think that this one could?
Well, I'm quite optimistic with this one because our blood vessels work the same way as in mice. This isn't a complicated disease like Alzheimer's. And so I think that I'd be surprised if there isn't some benefit in people. Of course, the challenge is to make a drug, and we have to make sure it's super safe, but we're already doing human studies over the road from my lab at Harvard, and so far it looks really good.
So if this research can be applied to humans, would it be used to help treat disease or just to get older people to exercise more?
Well, this would be both. We're working on having a drug available that your doctor could prescribe for you if you're feeling frail or you have a disease such as muscle wasting or even diabetes and even dementia. We think that this could be useful. But as a side effect, what we think the patients would notice would be improved stamina. When they wake up in the morning, they don't groan anymore. They can get back to exercising. And even people who have been in bed rest or in wheelchairs could potentially even get back to having mobility again.
There may be some people listening to this who say, well, I'm never going to be around when that pill finally comes out. But is there a message just about exercise and the importance of exercise in stopping the process of aging?
Well, yeah, that's nothing new. We know that exercise slows down aging and keeps your body from getting a variety of diseases. But what this offers is actually the ability to both augment exercise when you're young and when you're older, potentially even replace it and get people back on this virtuous cycle of mobility and ability to respond to exercise.
Even after this study, what are the questions you still have?
Well, mostly I want to know how safe it is. And those are the studies that are ongoing right now. But hopefully by the end of this year or early next, we'll actually know if the same effects are seen in human subjects. And it's pretty easy to test if somebody gets increased endurance. You don't have to wait years for the outcome. And then hopefully we'll be able to see with further studies if this actually truly reverses aging throughout the body. This molecule that we're giving the patients or the test subjects has the potential to actually extend lifespan in the same way it does mice. And so that's really the holy grail here that we're chasing.
That's Dr. David Sinclair, a professor and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biology of Aging at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sinclair, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to more about the Forever Young study at hereandnow.org.
The place is going to get awfully crowded.
Yeah. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Forever Young. I mean, Robin, it's Here and Now.